listener, welcome to Talent Chasing, where we bring real-world stories from the fields, courts, and pitches of major league sports and offices of corporate talent. It's our job to amplify those hidden stories and finding, retaining, and motivating the best talent in the world, because no team exists without great talent.
Hi, I'm Brian Johnson, former Major League Baseball player and former Major League Baseball scout.
I'm Jasper Spangart. I am a journalist and filmmaker.
And I'm Chad Sowash, recruitment industry veteran. Welcome to episode number one, Chasing Brian Johnson.
You think to yourself, where do we start with this? And we've got a sports star right among us, so it's sort of the easiest transition to go from there. Our very own sports star and co-host, I may add, Brian Johnson.
Yes.
Brian, who exactly are you?
Good question. I've been worrying about that for the last 50-some-odd years. But I guess I understand there may be one or two people on the planet that don't know exactly who I am.
Doing research on you, dude? Oh, yeah. My God.
Let me do a brief overview of my role, or one of my roles here today, being part of the guest. Born and raised in Oakland, California, a large baseball hotbed. Frank Robinson's from there, Kurt Flood, Joe Morgan, a bunch of other baseball legends. I grew up there. I went to Stanford University and played football and baseball there. I was a quarterback there as well as on the baseball team. We won two national championships there. And then I went on to play in the major leagues for 12 years. I had a lot of fun there. Left there, went into the corporate world for 9 years, went back into baseball as a major league scout. And we'll get into the differences of what a major league scout versus an amateur scout might be.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And then yeah. I left scouting after 10 years. So 22 years in baseball.
Wow.
And went back into the business world. So a thumbnail sketch of who I am. That's me.
That's not a thumbnail sketch. That's a big sketch.
That sounds more than one lifetime. Okay. That sounds like more than one lifetime, which is why today we're going to start the discussion around the chase, which is what great teams do. They identify, they engage, and then they chase talent, right? So in this case, it's all about chasing Brian Johnson, whether you can find him the right one on Google or not.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, yeah.
The guy from AC/DC, I get a lot of his stuff. I wish I got his paychecks, but I didn't. So, yeah.
So where did the sports bug catch you, hit you? Where did all this start?
Yeah. As a kid, you know, I kind of had a short attention span, and all I wanted to do was be around a ball. Didn't matter what ball it was. I played basketball. I was playing soccer a lot, or football. It should be called football, but that's a whole different story we can get into another time. But we, for some reason, in the United States, call it soccer, which is dumb, but whatever. But yeah, anything that had to do with the ball would have been, I was locked up in it. And so just this natural, really from my soul, kind of connection with soul movement, athletic competition, and all that, it just kind of was my thing.
Well, what was the first ball that you picked up?
I think it was soccer. My best friend, his dad was our coach. He was a orthopedic surgeon, and he was the team doctor for the Golden State Warriors, who were garbage back then, for Laney College, was a local junior college there, their football team and their soccer team. So he introduced us to soccer. I didn't know anything about soccer until we started playing together. So at 7 years old, we started playing and had a blast. So that was my first game.
Were there like pickup matches? You had your buddies in the backyard. Did you go to the park? I mean, what was the scene, especially in Oakland?
Yeah, well, you know, soccer on the park is kind of, it's around, right? There's more of an adult thing. Ours was more the, you know, the T-shirt league for soccer and for baseball. Where I really got serious about it was with baseball, because to your point, the leagues in soccer didn't really start till you're 10. So probably the first one was baseball. T-shirt league is what we called it. Your parents would pay 10, 15 bucks. You get a T-shirt and a hat. You come down to the recreational park at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you stay there all day. You play your game at 9, but you get to substitute in the game at 8:30 and then 9:30 in the game at 11 and 12. And when you're not playing in one of those games or substitute another game, you go play three flies up in the outfield. You play pickle or rundown is what we called it back then. You play pepper. I've coached a lot too. So a lot of kids nowadays don't know what pepper means. It's the great game you can do with just one person, one ball, or two people, one bat and one ball. So baseball is probably as far as getting serious about it was probably my first endeavor into that.
Well, talk about Oakland a little bit. What was the environment in Oakland? Because as a kid, I mean, I grew up in small town Ohio, right? We didn't have big major league sporting teams, right? Mm-hmm. You did. Right. Mm-hmm. You grew up in the shadows of that.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was a great time. It was the Charlie Finley Oakland A's of the early 70s. They won three World Series in a row.
Wow.
The Oakland Raiders was Otis Sistrunk and oh, John Matuszak and Kenny Stabler, the Snake. You know, so we had all those characters around, you know, for the Warriors had just before the Warriors won the championship in 74.
Uh-huh.
But cognitively, I didn't really check in until 75, 76. So I suffered for 40 years until the latest dynasty 40 years later. So that's a whole separate subject too. But I grew up in the city of Oakland, but a little tawny, white, upper middle class suburb called Montclair. And so my father is a cardiologist. My mother was an emergency room nurse. And a lot of the kids in that field that I would go to every morning were white. And there was one girl who she was awesome. Sarah Lillivan was her name. And there was a couple sprinkle of diversity, sprinkle of different folks, black folks mostly, didn't have a whole lot of Asian folks, didn't have a whole lot of Latino or Hispanic folks. Mm-hmm. And so from there was kind of where I started and got to be playing. And ironically, what happened to me, which changed my life, is that when I got into the first organized league where you get the full uniform, my coach was a black guy. He was going to law school at Cal Berkeley, which is right next door.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was in the middle of law school. He and his two law school buddies, the three of them, coached this little league team. And so when my head coach, Dennis Young, my head little league coach, noticed that I had something that was a little bit different, he took me off. And we were up in the hills of Oakland. He took me off of the hills and took me down into the flatlands. So in Oakland, there's the hills and there's the flatlands.
Mm-hmm.
So the flatlands is where the best athletics were, the best teams were, the best athletes were, the best competition. And they were all black communities for the most part, sprinkle of Latino and Hispanic folks. Again, not a whole lot of Asian folks. Asian folks kind of lived on a different side of town. They were kind of across the bay in San Francisco. But in Oakland, that's what we had. So this predominantly black city, this white kid went to start playing in those leagues. And it transformed my life.
What was your favorite part of growing up there?
We had a beautiful view at our house. We got to see the San Francisco Bay, the Bay Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge behind it. All of that I got to see every morning and every day. Mm-hmm. And it was a really delight and that I look back on having not been there for a long time. But the other piece is that because there are so many different types of people, there's so many different types of Asian people, there's so many different types of Latino folks and Hispanic folks.
Yeah.
So the black folks were varied, right? They came from so many different places. That, for me, was my favorite part of it. And still to this day, is the richness of the culture of Oakland. And if you ever meet anybody from Oakland, they'll tell you pretty much the same thing. We're all very arrogant about where we came from.
Yeah.
We know it was unique. We know it was different.
Yeah.
And in my life, I'm 56. I've never seen another place like Oakland anywhere in my travels.
Wow. So talk a little about you talked about the coach that first saw that you had a little something, right? Mm-hmm. Talk about the mentors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me, for any kid, whether in sports or not, I mean, that's a big part of their upbringing in their life, whether it's family, whether it's a coach. So talk a little bit about that. Who were your mentors that actually brought you along, whether family, coaches, who were they? Who were the most important ones to you?
Yeah, the first one I'd say was probably my mom. She and I were always best friends, still best friends to this day. She's 86 and plays golf 5 days a week.
Wow.
I love it. I love it.
Still driving a car.
Still driving.
Yeah, she don't necessarily remember what day it is today, but she can do everything else. But anyway, again, she grew up in the 30s. She was a golfer. Her father was a golfer.
Mm-hmm.
And so she became really good and was good enough at the end of high school to be potentially a pro golfer. But again, so she born in the 30s. So as a teenager, age, so that's basically 51, 52, 50, mid 50s.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a whole lot of money to be made for female golfers during that time.
Yeah.
So she was like, there's not a whole lot of money there. I'm going to go to nursing school and do my thing there. But that love of sport, that hand-eye coordination, which was key, because my dad didn't have a whole lot of it. My mom was the one that had it. But we connected on sports always. And so I think she was great. And she always used to tell me that, hey, because, you know, I felt like I was impressing people at 10 or whatever. I felt like I was big on the field, right? But my mom would always say, hey, just remember, there's always going to be somebody better than you. And that always stuck with me. Okay. I've done a lot of coaching. I got two kids that I've coached along the way. And I refuse to be that parent. But the example I'm using as my mom is that she never pushed me to do anything. She never said, hey, you got to work harder. Hey, you got to do this. She said the other thing, the other way around, she said, there's always someone better. And that kicked into where I was not going to let anybody outwork me. And so that's where my attitude came from. I said, oh, there's somebody better. Let me see. And so that kind of from 12 years old on was kind of my mentality of, okay, even if I'm not the better player on day one, maybe by day five, I'll catch him.
So mom's DNA, that's the sports DNA, huh? And apparently dad was not a surgeon. That's what I'm hearing. He's not good with his hands.
True. He was not a surgeon. Yeah. Probably not good with his hands would be accurate too. But yeah, I mean, so many other mentors along the way, but that was the first one. She was the first one and the big one. Joan Jett, because she drove too fast, was her nickname around the neighborhoods.
That's it.
So yeah, she was the first one and has been with me for this whole ride along the way.
That's amazing.
But was it tough to then? Because I think the mindset of there's always someone better than you. You just went into it slightly, and I might want to dive into that a little bit, because it is a form of parenting where you go, there's always going to be someone better than me.
It's passive aggressive.
Is it passive aggressive? I know she was jetting down all the lanes there in Oakland, but it's a bit in your face, I guess. What did that do to your psyche, though? Because you're always thinking everywhere you were going to go from 12 on, you were thinking someone was going to be there and there was going to be better than you.
Yeah, because at first I was offended. I was hurt.
Yeah,
I was like,
I get it.
I was like, what? It's
supposed to be in my corner, Mom.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Aren't I the apple of your eye? Yeah, we got my three other siblings. Yeah, okay, whatever, them too. But, you know, what kind of thing? So for a long time, I kind of took it as, wow, she doesn't think I'm good enough.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it wasn't until obviously later, I matured a little bit since I was 12. And I realized, whoa, that was amazing. Now, I didn't use that with my kids. Well, I used it in kind of different contexts. Because so with my thing, as I had my kids, everybody knows your dad was an athlete. Everybody knows your dad played in the major leagues. Everybody knows that. So there's pressure, inherent pressure on the kids of a former athlete.
Oh, hell yeah.
To be great right out of the chute. Never fail. If you make an error, well, your dad never made an error. Or if you strike out or you hit a home run, oh, your dad's home run probably was way farther than that. So, you know, that whole trip. But what was nice is that I didn't raise my kids in Oakland. I raised them in Detroit, Michigan. So no one knew me. And so I had an opportunity to really have a clean slate as a parent. But I tried to kind of take the lessons of my mom and say, hey, be the guiding force here. Keep them humble. Mm-hmm. Keep them working. Encourage. She did encourage. But you can also give them some hay. Say, hey, you're 14 years old. Hey, you're 16 years old. Hey, you got to keep moving, because you got to be able to have that mentality of you want competition. You don't shy away from competition.
It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. And I'm not meaning to hate on your mother's.
She's texting me right now. She's asking what your phone number is. Yeah.
Apparently it worked. Okay. Apparently it worked.
It did. I mean, you can say loads of things about it, but it did work. Yeah. Yeah. If we were to, because you dived into it a little bit too, like being aware of the fact that you're good at something. I feel like, especially now where you've got 12-year-old kids putting up their highlight reels on YouTube or Instagram or TikTok, and they've come to a sort of platform where you perhaps as a kid 10 years ago, you were striving to possibly be there in the future one day. And now they're putting out highlight reels and everyone's telling them how good they are. But how dangerous is it for that to happen, though? Because if everyone's telling you you're great at something, as a kid, you're going to believe it, right? You're going to think, well, except for your mum, maybe.
She's you want to believe it.
You have to believe it, maybe, even to be successful. But what was that like for you growing up in Oakland at that age? Because it's to stay even keel is quite tough.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it was easy on one part for me to be even keel because there was so much talent in the city during that time. During that time, there was talent everywhere. There was four or five of us from that era that went to the major leagues that played like couple dozen of us went to major Division I sports in several different sports. So a ton of talent during that era. But I would say also, yeah, it's tough for kids nowadays to keep that same mindset that I was able to keep because I strove to be seen, right? My part of my motivation is to be exposed and be seen, show what I can do, show my wares and compete against other people. And this instantaneous video that can go viral, you know, and you can have your own company in your living room and sell your widget on the other side of the planet. I mean, that just wasn't it when I was coming up. So it not a criticism of what it is now. It's an understanding that I didn't have that, and thank God I didn't. I could focus on what I liked. I could focus on trying to reach that level and get to where I needed to go instead of giving all the great gear and the thing. I mean, I got, you know, newspaper articles that were written, right? That was about the extent of it. But now your picture can be flashed up there. A video can be done over here. You can have thousands of followers. It's a different world. And so I'm grateful for the time that I grew up and that I didn't have any of that. And I could just really get into the essence and the beauty of competition and sport. And I don't think a lot of kids get that opportunity. There's so many other things to pull their time and attention away.
So much hype. I mean, I actually had a friend. Yeah. I was down in Atlanta, and one of my friends is talking about how they were picking out music for their son's walk-up music. We're talking about high school. I mean, this is travel. Yeah. We'll get into travel teams.
And technology, I mean, technology is fun. I would have done the same thing.
It's fun, you know? But.
And you would have too, Chad.
Oh, yes. No,
you would have wanted your own walk-up music.
I would have loved that. But is the time of, first and foremost, you played multiple sports. So baseball, football, basketball, and in high school, right?
Yeah.
But today, that's not how it's working out. We've got all of these travel clubs. We've literally focused on, hey, look, you've got to be playing this one sport all year round, right? Yeah. Where I played four, I was varsity letterman in four sports. Yeah. That was it, right? I did not go to college or anything like that, but I had an opportunity to go play it all and just enjoy myself. It sometimes does not feel like, whether it's walkout music or whatever it is, right? It does not feel like these kids are getting a chance, number one, to enjoy themselves. And number two, there are a bunch of kids that are out there that can't enjoy themselves because they can't afford the $5,000 to be able to be a part of the travel club or what have you.
And to be able to compete against the best.
They're missing the experience. Yep. Even if they don't make it to college, right? I didn't, but I loved that experience, right? So talk a little bit about that, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. And during the time when we grew up, right, people would flock to sports. People love sports. Mm-hmm. And even didn't matter if you were good or not. But now we're in an age, as you say, everybody who plays is going to be Tiger Woods. Everybody who plays is going to be Michael Jordan. And so I know we're going to do a whole different show later on the fleecing of the parents and sport, youth sports. But that's not what you're asking for me in this episode. For me, I feel like the real sadness of it is that when my kid goes to try out for the 10 through 12 year old team, there's no such thing as keeping kids that maybe haven't developed yet, that maybe aren't quite as good quite yet, but they may be, you know, young kids grow like trees, right? They can, at 11 or 12, they may be completely different. So, but they don't have a chance to play in any league.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the parents, to your point, got to pay so much money. So you only take the top five guys or girls or whatever it may be, the top five players.
Yeah. Right.
And so what do the other 50 players do? Back when I played, there was, like I said, the recreational league, t-shirt league, where we had 100 kids before they got to the full uniform league that could just play. No one cared.
Yeah.
No.
No one cared. We hit off the tee first, then coach pitch, and then whatever.
Right.
No one cared. You just got to play. You learned the game. You got to play. And that, I think, at its essence, if it's ever one thing, that was before the parents took over, before the almighty dollar took over. It could just be kids playing the game.
And I feel like, and chiming in from a European perspective, because obviously you guys talk about travel ball and you talk about that concept. That doesn't really exist here. But the same stuff happens here, because if you're a kid playing football, playing soccer football here in Europe, and you have to be sort of 8 years old and you have to sort of choose which sport do you want to pursue? Like, you can do field hockey, you can do basketball. Well, we're quite short, so no basketball. Okay. You play football. And because you're taught at a really early age, you can be good at one thing. You can't be good at like four sports, Brian. We can't all be Brian Johnson.
Chad was four sports. I was only three.
High
school.
In high school, yeah. But high school, because Brian, you are a very meticulous guy and you asked us to do plenty of research. So as a journalist, I take, you know, that very serious. That's a threat, man. That's a threat. So, but I also take my sources very seriously. Brian, I went to your Wikipedia page.
Surprisingly accurate, that page.
Yeah, you wrote it yourself or?
I don't know who wrote it, but it's surprisingly accurate.
Oh, well, good. But I also came across a post on Cougar Board. No, Chad, not that Cougar Board. It's all about BYU, guys. BYU, sports universities. Okay. But I came across this post, and I loved it. It's from 2005, and they're having a discussion about the best athlete they've ever competed with. And there's a comment from a guy called Pablo 393. Got to get it right because the people want to fact check this. Dated back to 2005. He says he was a senior at your high school in Oakland called Skyline High. That's correct, right? Skyline High. Okay. So he says the year is 1985 and Gary Payton and Greg Foster were both juniors and Brian Johnson was a sophomore.
No, we were all the same class. Gary, Greg, and myself were all juniors. It's close. It's all right.
It's very close. No, but he says, but this is now we're getting to the interesting stuff. So he says, most of you may know Payton and Foster.
I'm a little nervous.
Trust me. It's okay. So he says, most of you may know Payton and Foster, known for their hoops, of course, but Brian Johnson was an all-around stud. You may actually be Pablo.
I kind of like Pablo already. I like Pablo.
But he says Brian Johnson may have been the best athlete of that group. Now, Brian, were you?
Well, it depends on how you define athlete.
Yeah.
Because Gary was always special in that way. Greg doesn't really count because he was 7 feet tall. So it's kind of a... You know what I mean?
He had the height advantage.
He was athletic, but... it's hard to, he only played basketball, 7 feet tall, still growing, still early in his maturation. So, not a criticism of Greg, but he played in the NBA for a long time. He's coaching in the NBA so he's had an amazing career. But Gary was always special. So it, again, depends on what you define as athletic.
Did Gary play two sports in college?
No, he was just one.
Oh, he didn't. Okay.
Ooh. All the way through, only played basketball.
I think we've settled that discussion then.
Well, but he made it to the Hall of Fame. So and
yeah. And he's chatting to us. So.
I'm just trying to get Gary to come on the show.
Right. I might have to work on that.
You're right on the athleticism part because you feel like, you know, with the NFL runs combines and, you know, they measure guys' hands and, you know, MLB has obviously become data-driven to a T, as you know. And you've got like youth academies here in Europe where they're tracking players at an early age with AI and they sort of want to measure everything they can possibly measure. But how do you really measure athleticism? Because we're talking about it in Australia, it's a talking point, right? Athleticism. Mm-hmm. Okay, to be an athlete. Okay, you can play multiple sports. Well, Chad wins the athleticism contest if we were to try that. I'm not sure that's totally valid. But like, how do you look at that though? Because how can you consider someone to be an athlete?
For me, the way I do it, again, this is coming from a scout. My job for 10 years was evaluating talent. And I know we'll get into that another time. But what I think the best way to do it, because I'm a simple guy. I need you to kind of paint me a simple picture so I could put my arms around it. Mm-hmm. So for me, the best way to identify a great athleticism is who jumps off the page at you. When you're watching a game, who jumps off the page? Mm-hmm. Who is it that is really spectacular? And it doesn't have to be the person to score the highest points, doesn't have to be the prettiest jump shot, but who athletically is dominating the interplay, the dance routine on the floor or on the pitch or whatever field you may choose. The game will tell you who the best is. And that's what I kind of used as my scouting piece is that you really just read the game and read the players within the game. They'll tell you, and the cream will rise to the top, even in a 5-on-5 pickup game somewhere in the Netherlands of a basketball player, 10 basketball players. The best will, it'll be just relax, just watch, and you'll know who the best athlete is on that group. So that's how I see it.
Well, here's the segue. When did the scouts finally figure out that Brian Johnson was a guy who leaped off the page, right? How many times did you have to win, you know, best athlete in California before they actually started to show up and they started scouting you?
Yeah, great question. Nowadays, everybody has to pay to go to Florida, the state of Florida, for some tournament, or California for some tournament in Southern California. And then everybody kind of flocks there. So if you don't have the money to go to California, that part of California or to Florida or Texas, you're out of luck. And so for me, what happened when I was coming up is that the local colleges and the baseball teams, their scouts lived in the area. Mm-hmm. Their scouts lived there. And so there was they'd done their homework. And so they had a feel for the competition level in the city. And so I was watched early on, because our school was 3 years, sophomore, junior, and senior, right? As a sophomore, it was my first year in high school. I start off a junior varsity for like a game, I think. Mm-hmm. And our team that year was the state champion. We were number one in the state in baseball. And I was on the junior varsity for one game. And then I came to varsity and, you know, dominated. So that was when I first splashed on the scene. And so the local scouts took wind of that. They read the articles. They saw things were around there. Saw our team getting more and more notoriety. So all of us within the team were getting noticed, and the seniors more so. But then, as I say, scouts are trained to do this. Who jumped off the page for them? Some of them said, that little kid over there who had a lot of hair at that point, that little kid over there, that's somebody I want to keep an eye on. So they kept an eye on me for the next 2 years. And then when I was a senior in high school, I had been a two-time All-American, and I was drafted up until the day before the draft. I was projected to be a number one draft pick, first round. Mm-hmm. And back then, it was like $160,000, but college was a whole lot cheaper back then. Everything was cheaper back then.
Yeah.
So it was all relative. Mm-hmm. But I was called and told by the Giants they'd take me in the second round if I was still there. Cincinnati Reds would take me in the first round. Boston Red Sox would take me in the first round. And so once we got to the day before the draft, they called with a little more serious tone of, listen, if we draft you here, we need to know if you're going to sign. Because if we draft you and you don't sign, someone's going to lose a job.
Yeah.
Because that's serious capital for an organization, a first-round pick.
Yeah.
And I was a catcher, a catcher that can hit was kind of my forte. But I was also throwing 94 off the mound as a pitcher. So it was another team wanted me as a pitcher, whatever. Because I was in high school and the athleticism was there, that there was a willingness to kind of take a chance on that. So the day before the draft, I had a conversation with my parents and my mom especially. And she's like, hey, what are you going to do? If you get drafted, you're going to sign. And I was like, well, I kind of like just the idea of being drafted. I want to go to school. I want to go to Stanford and play football and baseball. Mm-hmm. But it'd be cool to just have that, you know, have that button on my shirt that I got drafted in the first round. And she was like, no, that's not how things are done. That's dishonest. So if you have no intention of signing, you call those people up and tell them, thank you, but you're not signing. And that's what I did. She was right. And I called everybody up, said, hey, appreciate it, but I'm not going to, no matter what you offer me, I'm not going to take it. I want to go to school. And so I ended up not going in the first round, but the Montreal Expos in the 30th round, the last round at that point, 30 rounds back then, the Montreal Expos, the only telegram I ever received in my life. I got a telegram from a renowned scout during those days. He wrote the telegram. He's like, hey, appreciate, respect your opinion or respect your decision. And this is a team that I had never heard of before. I hadn't even been in contact with the Montreal Expos at that point, but said, hey, if you change your mind, the Montreal Expos would love to have you, type. And so that was the high school experience. And it was kind of a bizarre time.
Now, is there a scout? Is there a scout in college that was like, he felt like he just picked up a big bag of gold? I mean, you were getting ready to go into possibly first round Major League Baseball.
First round.
Yeah. And now, oh, wait a minute. Now we've got the guy, we've got him falling into our lap. Not only that, you were two sports, right? Quarterback.
Yeah.
And obviously baseball. So tell me about that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how that happened too. So I got a letter from the baseball team, whatever. Uh-huh. In the summertime, I went to a football camp because I was getting some offers for football, but it was a little tepid at the time. So my running back and I from high school, Raymond Sanders was his name. He would go on to Cal Berkeley as a running back and really had a great career there. But we went to this camp at Stanford. And it's like an hour away, but neither one of us had cars. So it was like on the other side of the planet for us.
Yeah.
But so we go to this camp, and there was Mark McGuire's brother, Dan McGuire, there. There was a bunch of guys there. There was the year of the quarterback coming up in California. So it was a whole bunch of some of the best prospects across the country. It was John Elway's camp. He ran the camp. His dad, Jack Elway, was the head coach at Stanford. Mm. So it was a John and Jack Elway football camp. So as it turned out, Raymond and I did really well. We play on the same team. We kind of dominated. Our group won the little championship 7-on-7. And so we really were able to kind of turn some heads there at the camp because there's a bunch of other schools that come to recruit. Well, it just so happened that Stanford saw me and liked me and liked that I was local. And so anyway, I ended up going there or thinking about going there. But the baseball coach heard from the football coach that they were going to give me a scholarship. And then all of a sudden I became more attractive because they already had the number one recruiting class in the nation.
In baseball?
And then they added me onto it and for baseball.
Yeah, okay.
Because we won the national championship in baseball my freshman year and sophomore year, back. And the only two championships they have are Stanford baseball, though they've had some great teams there.
Yeah.
And hopefully they'll win this year. But so anyway, so I was there. So the baseball wanted me to come play baseball and football. And I was like, great. But I kind of negotiated a little bit. I said, listen, I don't want anybody pulling me in one direction or the other. Because I was going to go I was thinking about University of Michigan and University of Arizona or UCLA. Mm-hmm. And each of those examples, the football coach or the baseball coach would pull you, Jasper, to your point, pull you to specialize, pull you into and be solely our guy. And I said, I don't want anybody doing that. Don't do that. I'll come to Stanford and I'll play both football and baseball, but I want to be able to play both all 4 years. And they agreed. Now, it didn't happen necessarily that way, but they agreed. They still pulled a little bit, but it wasn't bad. And it was an amazing experience to be able to play two sports, have fun kind of still as a kid, and really get an opportunity to show what I could do. And I was very fortunate to come up during that time when that was still allowed.
Was baseball your favorite sport, or is that just the one that you were better at? So maybe it did become your favorite because you were better at it.
Well, I think basketball was my favorite.
Really? Okay.
Basketball was my favorite, but I was not as good in basketball as I was the other two. Like I could street ball, like one-on-one, like on that I was good with that. But four other guys on the court, much less nine other guys on the court, that's too much. That's too much going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was not as good in basketball. But within football and baseball, I really loved them both. I took baseball a little bit for granted because everybody kind of knew me as a baseball guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was kind of driven by challenges. So I wanted to prove I was a football player too. So, you know, at being the quarterback, there's a whole lot of time commitment. So it took away from my baseball a little bit. And I didn't really play that great at the college level for baseball. But at the end of the day, so I had to have a conversation with our head coach was Dennis Green at the time. Coach Elway had been fired.
Really?
Whole for different story
Dennis
to that.
Dennis Green.
I was involved in the process to get him out. I can say that now. I'm 56. I don't have to worry about
it. You don't care anymore.
I don't care anymore. But there was a coup d'etat at our school over Jack Elway.
Really? Yeah.
And so myself and about eight other guys, there was a lot of things going on. But so he was removed. Dennis Green, who had just come off Super Bowl wins with the San Francisco 49ers, came in. He was he learned under Bill Walsh. So he was a Bill Walsh protege. So he comes down to Stanford, takes over. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of my time there, there was a possibility that I might get drafted football. And I had already been drafted in baseball. Mm-hmm. And there were some whispers of maybe get drafted again for baseball. And so I went to Dennis Green and said, hey, man, here's what I'm facing. What would you do? Should I come back, play another year of football? Should I go ahead and play if I get drafted to go play baseball? I really like playing football. But, you know, do you think I'm good enough to play in the NFL? Essentially is what I was asking. And we had a great relationship. We had a great conversation. He's like, I can't tell you that. It didn't help me at all. He's like, I can't tell you that. You got to do what you love more and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And he really didn't help me at all. But so I had to really grow up and say, okay, business decision. What do I need to be good in football? I needed a perfect offense because I'm 6'2", so I'm not 6'5".
Yeah.
You know, I don't run like the wind, but I can move around the pocket well and get myself 10 yards. But at the end of the day, I could dominate in baseball tomorrow as a catcher.
Yeah.
I was bigger as a catcher. I could hit as a catcher, which made me unique. So I felt like I need the right offense for football, but tomorrow I can dominate. So that's kind of what it came down to, a business decision of not what I enjoyed most, because I'd go play basketball if that was it.
Yeah.
It was from a business standpoint of which one was better for me to put all of my time in now. And that's how baseball became the ultimate decision.
So we always hear about how the speed of play is so much different, at least on football, on the football side of the house, from one level to the next, right? You go from high school to college, speeds up dramatically. Go from college to, you know, to the pros, it's warp speed. What was that like for you? What was that the case? Did you, were you just a man playing a boy's sport in high school? Then you came into college and it was like, I'm here. I've made it. Or was there a huge difference in speed? Did you have to get used to a lot of things on the football side and baseball side?
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. Absolutely. Cause that is the defining factor.
Yeah.
In the two sports that I experienced. And I know it's basketball too. I've heard that, but it is the speed. And so it takes a little while to get used to. That's why the athleticism that comes into play is so important, because if you're an athlete and you have sound fundamentals, so that's why coaches harp on fundamentals so much, is because if you have sound fundamentals, right, where your footwork is correct on turning a double play, if your feet, if you're able to utilize your lower half as a hitter to generate thrust and power to hit the ball. As a quarterback, if you're able to use your legs and your feet to be more accurate as a passer, as a guard in basketball, use your shoulders correctly and your feet correctly to be more accurate. If your fundamentals are sound, you can adapt to the speed of the game. If your fundamentals are not sound and inconsistent, when the game speeds up, you're going to get spit out by the game and you're not going to be able to adjust. So that's the difference. That's the essence. Again, I like simple stuff.
Yeah.
If your fundamentals suck, you will suck as the speed picks up on the college level or the pro level.
Yeah.
And I think
because it's only going to get faster, right?
Exactly.
It's only going to get faster and faster, like the higher you go. So,
and you can't, and if you have to unlearn bad habits, you're losing time. It becomes a matter of time and speed.
Right.
You got to develop quickly. You got to be able to adjust to the speed quickly. And if you don't, there's 50 other guys that will take your spot.
So it's funny. So quick story. I was actually in training as in the military. So we were going through asymmetric warfare and we were getting trained by Delta Force, right? Mm-hmm. And invariably.
All that sounds cool.
Yeah, it sounds so cool, mate. You've just made Brian Johnson less cool.
This goes with the story, okay? Anyway. Invariably, somebody always asks the question, some dumb E5s, like, what do you guys do different? What's different between you know, the Delta Force and the SEALs, right? Mm. And there was one answer, and it was perfect. We do the basics better than anyone. It's not about advanced. It's about the basics. Exactly what you just said. The way that you get to the next level is not trying to be the advanced, you know, dunk. Know, or posterizing somebody. It's about the basics. Yeah. So I think that goes all the way through, whether it's military, sports, the corporate side of the house, right? Everything that we're talking about now, I think got to get the basics right.
I agree completely. And there's got to be a love for it, that you're able, that working at it is not work, it's fun.
Exactly, yeah.
The fundamentals, working at it and enjoying it. All those things transfer to no matter what you're doing. I completely agree.
You mentioned that you took baseball for granted. Did that do anything in terms of your development then? Because if you're just extremely talented at something and you just take it for granted, what does that mean?
And take it for granted could be to varying degrees. I definitely worked at it in college, but football dominates in college, right?
Yes.
Their spring football had to be it. Because again, if I was like, so Deion Sanders was coming out and Bo Jackson, we all were kind of around them. They were a little bit older than me, but I kind of aspired to be them. And I wanted to play both sports at the professional level. But then I realized over time, because everybody's like, oh, yeah, sure. Either, oh, yeah, sure, go for it. Or there's no way you'll ever do it. So I love the no way you'll ever do it. I always like to remember that stuff.
Uh-huh.
But what happened was I realized that I couldn't do it as a quarterback, because a quarterback has to be at every meeting, every practice, everything that has to be done. As a running back, you can just show up and play the next day. as a cornerback, you can show up and play the next day, essentially. Not to take anything away from them, but as the game, no one is really coordinating with the running back. Yeah, there's some timing with the offensive lineman, okay. But the quarterback, everything centers around that position. So you can't have the quarterback not be there. So once I realized that, that was a big deal. So so that's why I kind of took baseball for granted a little bit. I was like, oh, I'm good, whatever. And but the problem was our baseball team was so good. I sat on the bench a lot in college, especially my freshman year. And I was pissed. I didn't handle it real well. I was angry. My son, you know, sits on the bench now. He's playing college baseball. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, he'll sit on the bench and have to work his way up. He handles it so much better than I did. But I was pissed. I was angry. So I think from a standpoint of I put so much time into football, I kind of assumed baseball would always be there. I kind of assumed I could just click it on mm-hmm. and get after it. But the competition was so good. Our team was so good. I couldn't break the starting lineup for that first year. So, but what was nice about that experience, again, the whole idea of you don't have to everything be roses and compliments and you're the greatest thing ever. Mm-hmm. You know, I struggled. The first class I took in college, I flunked because I wanted to play baseball and run and chase around the girls. But then I turned around, played two sports and graduated on time in 4 years with my degree. And so that was a good experience. My freshman year, I sat on the bench, both baseball and football. Football, I redshirted. So it was good because I had to work at it and wait for my turn. Mm-hmm. So what was nice about kind of taking for baseball for granted and so much football dominant in college is that once I decided, hey, baseball is going to be the sport that I choose, now my motivation and my enjoyment of the game is so much better because I played left field for 2 years. I was bored to tears. Bored to tears.
Picking daisies.
I was so bored. It couldn't even – what happened was when I show up to the baseball field freshman year, been playing football for 6 weeks. Everybody uh-huh. else been playing together during the fall season for 6 weeks. I show up in the spring. All the positions are taken but right field.
Yeah, we got a spot for you, Brian.
Exactly. And now right field, those guys can play. Anyway,
wow.
So my coach says, hey, have you ever played the outfield? I was like, I never played the outfield a day in my life. I was like, absolutely. I play it all the time. And so I was out there in the outfield. So I backed up 7 different positions at the college level.
Wow.
And except for catcher and second baseman. I never caught a day in my college career, but then went on to be a catcher at the major league level. So go figure.
You were the ultimate utility guy. You could play everywhere. Just plug and play.
Athleticism. Fundamentals early on.
But talk about utility, though, because you're talking about two sports that are completely different. You're talking about using different muscles, different timing. I mean, it is completely different. So when you're prepping as a quarterback, right? I mean, that in itself is like a college course, right? You're prepping as a quarterback. And then, you know, you've got to get your muscle memory.
And we had three different offenses while I was there.
God. Well, then
you got to learn a new one every year.
You get your muscle memory in place for that one sport, right? And then you've got to go to the other one where, you know, obviously football, there's a lot. I mean, timing is everything, but baseball, obviously it is timing, right?
Yeah.
It is timing. So what was the difference there? Is that one of the reasons why you knew you had to disconnect from the one that you were not going to go pro in, or at least have a chance to, and say, okay, boom, this is my ride. I've got to focus here.
Yeah. And it's interesting you said, because the way I looked at it back then is baseball and football was really the same script of music, the same sheet of music, just athletically. Mm. It just made sense to me, both of them.
Okay.
But to your point, once I decided, I realized, hey, the key factor is that, hey, I can't play both professionally because I realize as a quarterback, my role, if I want to be a good quarterback, I have to be there. And so if I can't miss anything, because again, Bo goes off and plays baseball. Deion goes off and plays baseball at the Yankees. Bo goes plays baseball at the Kansas City Royals. Then they pop in late in training camp or the first couple of games and they go play football. Quarterbacks can't do that. So once I realized that, then I had to pull away from my love of football, really focus on one and get after it. And hopefully I didn't lose too much ground and maybe get a chance to play at the major league level. So, and I was my junior year in college, I was drafted as a third baseman. I was drafted as a third baseman by the New York Yankees.
Okay.
The Yankees had taken John Elway 4 or 5 years earlier.
Wow.
And he was an outfielder, obviously, with a big cannon.
Yeah.
And so George Steinbrenner was a big fan of the Stanford guy, of the Stanford quarterback.
Oh.
So George Steinbrenner kind of had enjoyed the idea of the Stanford quarterback. And so that's where I got some love. And there was a local scout in Sacramento from the Yankees that would come. And anyway, so he drafted me and the Yankees drafted me. And sure enough, I go play rookie ball. I come back after my first year. My agreement with the Yankees is that I'd be able to continue to play football and graduate. So I came back from rookie ball with the Yankees, came back, played as a quarterback and had one of my best games at Arizona State, playing against the leading passer in NCAA history at the time. So it was against him. We were driving. We were down by 4 points, fourth quarter. Had probably one of my best games of my career, a 65-yard touchdown, 85-yard touchdown. And then we were in a two-minute drill. My tight end's over there. I feel pressure coming from my backside. I throw the ball at my guys, at my tight end's feet, because he was covered. Uh-huh. And I was ready to take the hit. And so he picked me up. The linebacker got underneath me, picked me up in the air, and landed. My shoulder landed first, and all my weight landed on, then all his weight landed on me. And my right shoulder just exploded. I had a fifth-degree separation. I had a clavicle that dislocated posteriorly.
Damn.
And my clavicle split in the joint, split like that. So anyway, long story short, I recovered from that. But it's just the, you know, I'd been told my whole life, oh, football, you're going to get hurt. Oh, football, you're going to get hurt. And I was like, no, I'm not going to get hurt. I'm Mr. Wonderful. I'll never get hurt. And I'm a dumb kid. You know, you can't hurt me. And so when I got hurt, that was another wake up call for me. It was like, oh, okay. Showtime. Oh, because what happened was I got hit, right? I'm landing on the turf. Yeah. My shoulder exploded. I'm like, oh my God, I don't know what happened. I literally rolled over at Arizona State in Tempe, Arizona, mm-hmm. rolled over, 60,000 people in the stands. I rolled over, looked up in the sky. It's like, oh my God, what did I do to my baseball career? That's the first thought that came to my head. And so that's when I knew, okay, I'm supposed to be playing baseball.
There it is. There it is.
That's the most unique intervention story I think I've ever heard. Like, you had to get blindsided by a huge guy. For you to separate your shoulder, for you to think, oh, actually, kind of like baseball.
Just that point.
So, Brian, I was curious because you sort of talked over it, the fact that you were a Division I athlete, both in baseball and football, and you were recruited by all these colleges. Now,
highly recruited.
Highly recruited, actually, yeah, because you were the star of the baseball team. You were a really good quarterback. But you get sort of, for me, the picture that comes to mind is you're playing, you're off, you're doing your training, you're exercising. You've got these sort of scouts there, and they're on the side of the pitch or the field, and they're sort of lurking and they're sort of writing stuff down. And what was that like for you? And what was your first interaction with a scout maybe that really struck you?
Yeah, good question. It's hard to, well, again, as a young kid, I'm in high school, right? We didn't really have a whole lot of interaction with them. Because remember back then, the big rules was you can't even sniff professional stuff as an amateur athlete.
All right. Yeah.
So there was big rules around that. And so the college scouts were only allowed to speak to us through our head coach, through our high school coach.
Okay.
So I didn't have a whole lot of interaction with the scouts at the time. I knew they were there. Mm-hmm. I could tell they were there. Mm-hmm. You know, they sit behind the screen. You can tell who's sitting out there.
Yeah.
And it's usually always all old guys, you know. And so I would hear secondarily about what they thought. But they wouldn't share a whole lot, but they would ask. You could get a feel for how they thought by the questions that they asked. Mm-hmm. So on the football side, I never got to see them. Well, except they would come like during lunchtime. And so, coaches would come. A lot of them were at the camp that I told you about. But coaches would come during lunchtime. So they'd call you down to the gym. You shake hands and, hey, blah, blah, blah. Hey, we think you're really good. We'd love for you to come down to University of Southern California or UCLA or Washington or Michigan. I went on a Michigan trip. It was really interesting. A guy almost died on us, but whatever.
but whatever.
Yeah. So I didn't have a whole lot of interaction. Again, my my liaison, my unofficial agent was my high school coach. So he kind of vetted people. He kind of was there. We were really close. Okay. He's like a father figure for me. So he was kind of the liaison and also my football coach. Tony Fardella was the football coach. Joe Pinella, two Italian guys were my coaches there. And they were really the ones that were kind of the filters before they got to me. So it wasn't until later on where I became a college player and then a professional player and then actually a scout where I really appreciated more as to what that process was.
So no movie high school, like every movie we see, right? It's like, you know, the coaches come into the living room and they look the mom and dad square in the eye and they say, your boy's going to be fine with us. Right. That didn't happen. None of that happened.
No, that happened.
Okay. Go on. Yes. Yeah. So the movies are always right, aren't they?
The best one.
Yes.
Was a guy named Jerry Kendall.
Okay.
He was University of Arizona college baseball coach. Uh huh. And he brought his wife, and he was a nice, kind man. He came to my parents' house and spoke with all of us and had a great time and just had really nice things to say about me. And I ended up not going there, but that process was pretty interesting. Everybody else kind of came through the school, so no one else came to the house.
Okay. So the personal touch.
Yeah, but then when I signed with the Yankees, that was when I was in college, right? So I had breakfast with the Yankee scout, which was kind of intimidating. And
was he from New York or where was he from?
He's from Sacramento, which is, you know, a couple hours north of where I was at Stanford. And so I didn't really like him because he didn't give me everything that I wanted. I was a 16th round pick. I wanted first round money. And that, for some reason, they weren't feeling that. I don't know why.
Strange. I don't know why.
But they did give me 4 years of college of tuition when I was done playing, whenever that may be. I could utilize that. So that was kind of where I was able to cash in a little bit. I never used it. I was going to use it to go to law school, but different story. But what's interesting is that guy, I can't remember his name to save my life right now, but Yankee scout, when I became a scout, I ran into him 30 years later.
Wow.
And I met with him in Detroit. It happened to be Detroit, in the press box, because that's where all the pro scouts kind of meander and get food before the game and all that. So I saw him one day and we chit-chatted. No, I'm sorry. It was in Toronto. It was Toronto. And so we chit-chatted and I was like, hey, man, I said, let me tell you something. Thank you so much for believing in me and giving me a chance to play baseball. I didn't say that to you before because I was a dumb kid and I was mad because you didn't give me enough money.
Yeah.
And I've never run into you since then. But now I have a chance. Thank you for giving me a chance. It was a great ride. And if for that moment in time, if you hadn't have done that, I might not have had the opportunity. So it was a great opportunity to be able to say thank you to somebody that was important.
And he didn't ask you what your name was?
He just goes, sorry, who are you?
Now, see, he got a lot of praise for me because I was a 16th round pick.
Yeah.
Most 16th round picks don't make it to the big leagues.
There we go. You were probably good for his career. Yeah.
That's a feather in his cap where he said that as well, is that, hey, you helped me out quite a bit because blah, 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 blah. So
mutually beneficial. Yeah.
Beneficial.
But he did remember my name, Chad. And that was that was even better. That was even more of a monumental moment that he didn't say, who are you? What? Who are you again?
I mean, obviously, you know, those guys have to be on their game because they see so many people, many athletes constantly. I mean, not just year after year, but week after week. Right. And then all the research that they have to do and whatnot.
When I was a scout, I did 1200 reports a year on one player. So 1200 individual reports in one season.
That is amazing. Well, kids, we'll get into that into future episodes. That's just a little tease, but Brian, you know, again, thanks again for being co-host. I'm not going to thank Jasper. We appreciate appreciate you giving some of the stories, man. I mean, one of the things that when Jasper approached me about doing this podcast, I got excited was for these conversations. Because nobody's having these conversations. They're not going deep enough to find out who the people are. And hopefully we'll get a chance to find out a little bit more about Brian Johnson, not just in this episode, but in the many other episodes that we'll be able to do. So appreciate it, man.
I appreciate that. But I got to be honest, this is not my favorite episode. I want to hear all the other guests that we get. I want to hear their stories.
I'm excited.
Man. I think like you said, like it's so important because we talk about these sports stars and we talk about the Shohei Ohtanis of the world and we talk about all these big guys, but we don't really talk about the guys who discovered them. And that's like, they're the ones that have actually done a lot of work, the 1200 reports. True. So like to give them a platform, that would be
they're the sourcers.
And I think what you're going to find is a lot of folks, there's different stories too, but some people, but most every one of I think the people that we're going to be interviewing really appreciate, just as I did later on, really appreciate those other people that helped along the way. So it's going to be a lot of fun to hear those stories from everybody else,
just to be able to watch them reflect. I think for me is pretty amazing, right? Listening to the story is amazing, but just the watching you go through it and just like you can see you reflecting on those stories, that to me is magic. So again, Brian, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Until next time, guys, we will be back. Chad, Jasper, and Brian, we're going to have obviously more discussions like this. Brian's already pitched. He's dropped names like Gary Payton, Dennis Green. I mean, it's
Dennis died. Dennis died. We can't get him.
Oh, God. That'd be weird.
We will get the Ouija board out for Dennis Green. I promise. Excellent, guys. I appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Talent Chasing with Brian Johnson, Chad Sowash, and Jasper Spanjar. Don't forget to subscribe to Talent Chasing on your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next time.